Bottom line, if they're squirrely, perk them and boot them. You like that?
I like it. Atelectrauma, a new concept. A-T-E-L-E-C-T-R-A-U-M-A. Say that four times fast. Atelectrauma, 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 atelectrauma. Good job. We're going to talk about the nascent trial, looking at a silver-lined endotracheal tube. Something tells me in a couple more years we're going to be using endotracheal tubes with specific linings to prevent infection.
Yeah, I think it could be a silver lining of the dark cloud of ventilator-associated pneumonia.
I like that. the raciest topic, Clay. Etomidate adrenal insufficiency.
It does inhibit 11-beta-hydroxylase. It causes 11-beta-congenital adrenal hyperplasia.
For a 24-hour period, approximately. I think that's what we're going for
right
now.
It's a transient CAH. The effect is short, lasts maybe up to 24 hours.
The genitalia remain the same.
Yeah, I think if that was a problem with the etomidate,
we'd be back to Versed so quick.
Hello, welcome to Keeping Up. This month, we're presenting the top 10 pulmonary critical care articles from the past 12 months. We've worked hard to do the searching for you and have handpicked these articles from over 60 journals to bring the very best, most relevant articles to help keep you up with emergency medicine literature. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, enjoy, and start keeping up with emergency medicine literature. And I have here with me Ben Heverin. Are you ready to get started?
Let's rock and roll.
All right, for our first article, this is written by Anderson et al. Computed tomographic pulmonary angiography versus ventilation perfusion lung scanning in patients with suspected pulmonary embolism, a randomized controlled trial. This was in JAMA December of 2007. The historical backdrop. Pulmonary thromboembolism is a problem. Its presentation's often subtle, and if you miss it, it could kill your patient. PE is the third leading cause of cardiovascular death and causes 5-10% of in-hospital mortality. Now, in the past, the VQ scan or ventilation perfusion scan was the non-invasive modality of choice for the diagnosis of PE. However, as CT technology has advanced, it's rapidly become the imaging modality of choice for the diagnosis of PE, despite having little to no evidence to support its use. We as ED docs really like CT scan because it's fast. It gives us a yes or no answer instead of a this prob, that prob, whatever prob, like a VQ scan. And it may find an alternative explanation for the patient's symptoms. Sometimes there will be a pneumonia or a pneumothorax or something that's not readily visualizable on a plain chest x-ray. A VQ scan, if normal, is extremely powerful in ruling out PE. But if the VQ is low or intermediate probability, the post-test probability for PE can still range from 10 to 40%. CT doesn't appear to be stellar either. Sensitivities in the past for CT in the diagnosis of PE have ranged from 53 to 100%. Now, of course, this is in the era of single slice detectors. PioPED 2 found that CTA alone in four-row scanners, some 8 to 16 row detectors, was 83% sensitive. And if you added a CT venogram, or CTV, CT venogram, then the sensitivity rose to 90%. No one has ever compared CT and VQ head-to-head until this article. Now, we've covered the historical backdrop. What do you need to know for your boards? For the board relevance, you need to know the risk factors for DVT and PE, some of which are nicely summarized in the Wells criteria. Wells criteria are clinical signs and symptoms of DVT, PE more likely than alternative diagnosis, heart rate greater than 100, immobilization or surgery in the previous 4 weeks, previous DVT or PE, hemoptysis, or malignancy that's active, treatment within the last 6 months, or they're receiving palliative care. And it's a scoring system, and you get a certain number of points for each of those variables. Now, on to the results of the article. 1,417 patients with a Wells score greater than 4.5 or a positive D-dimer were randomized to receive either VQ or CTPA, CT pulmonary angiogram. Exclusions were what you would expect. Pre-existing DVT or PE less than 3 months prior to the study, if they're already anticoagulated, pregnant, expected to survive less than 3 months, allergic to IV contrast, that would obviously kick them out. And they were randomized to undergo CT pulmonary angiogram or VQ. And on the written materials that you can find online, we show the algorithm for the study on our materials taken from the article. The bottom line is, the patients who had suspicion for PE were randomized to one of two treatment or two diagnostic arms. And those were followed until either PE was excluded or PE was ruled in, and then they were treated appropriately. All patients were followed up at 1 week and at 3 months by phone. 7 were lost to follow-up in the CTPA group and 4 in the VQ scan group. More pulmonary emboli were detected in the CT pulmonary angiogram group than the VQ, 19% versus 14%. And at 3-month follow-up, CT pulmonary angiogram was found not inferior to VQ in detecting the primary outcome of recurrent DVT or PE. That is, 0.4% of patients that had a CTPA later were found to have had either a DVT or PE versus 1% in the VQ group, and that was not statistically significant between those two groups. So the bottom line is this: CT found more clots than VQ, and at follow-up, there was a trend that fewer people in the CT group ended up with DVT or PE. Now, how does this apply to your practice? So on your next shift, it means that you can scan with confidence. I mean, we've been doing that already. I mean, I know that my imaging choice when I'm looking for a pulmonary embolus is CT. I very rarely order a VQ scan. So what this study helps to show is that what we've been doing for years actually has a solid scientific basis. The VQ scan's role is now diminishing, I see. The problem with this study is it found a lot of clots, and it may have found too many clots. That is, CT might be too good, and some of these little clots might not even be significant, which is going to mean that people are going to get anticoagulated, have adverse bleeding outcomes. And so the editorial suggests that maybe CT finds too many clots, clots that aren't significant. What do you need to know for your next shift? You need to know if you suspect PE, get the scan. CT is very helpful. It's now been shown to be not inferior to a VQ scan, and you'll often find an alternative diagnosis. So what are your thoughts?
Well, I think you hit it right there, Clay. We all order CT scan. I can't remember the last time I ordered a VQ scan. I don't think a lot of people can. A VQ scan's annoying to me. I can order it between 9 and 5 with an hour and a half off for lunch when the new med people are reading right there. I can't order it during the weekends. Now, there's a role for that. Let's talk about a patient who comes in with good, high suspicion. I want to look at what's going on in the lungs, but they've got a creatinine of 4 and they've got contrast allergy, and I need to get things moving now. Yeah, in that case, we need to know how a VQ works, but this gives us data to allow us to practice like we do, which is use the CT scan almost exclusively for analyzing PE. And with the newer generational CT scans that we're going to talk about a little bit more, CT scan is the testing modality of choice.
Yeah, I see it that way as well. Also, a VQ scan is not necessarily getting you less radiation than a CT pulmonary angiogram.
You know, the downside to a CT is radiation and contrast, but it's worse. If you go ahead and talk to the radiologist, if you do appropriate shielding for a PE protocol CT scan versus a VQ scan for somebody who's pregnant, the fetus is getting more radiation with a VQ scan than the appropriately shielded device. So I think the radiation point is mute here, comparing these two back and forth.
It really is. And often what will be shown is the ventilation portion and the perfusion portion separately when they're looking at radiation exposure to the fetus. But you have to look at both. It's a V and a Q. It don't do so much good with just a V or just a Q. So anyhow, so radiation as well, it's
radiation's bad, but you're not getting any extra bang for your buck in choosing one test over the other for radiation. If anything, CT's actually better here. We know that from our nuclear studies with our cardiac stress test, too.
True. Scan them.
All right, Clay, let's go on to Article 2 here. We're going to continue with this PE rule-out theme. This is the Regini article from Lancet, April 2008. When we talk about ruling out PE, I want to know, do I really need that ultrasound anymore? Yep. When I have those chest pain complaints that are concerning for pulmonary embolus, how valuable is that ultrasound? And that's what this study is looking like. So when you think about it, PE we can't miss. You talked about it, third leading cause of cardiovascular mortality, significant morbidity for missed PE, and it's a tough diagnosis. when you think about the signs and symptoms. So we have to think about it right there. Obviously, we know from an operational standpoint, it takes me a complete day. If I want to go D-dimer, boom, that's positive. Now I get ultrasounds, they're negative. Maybe I should get a PE after that. That's a frustrating 8-hour workup for my patients in the ED, too. So what's the best way to do that while I'm still protecting my patients and ruling out a devastating and life-threatening disease? Remember, we've got to talk about old CT scanners and new CT scanners for our historical backdrop. The old scanners only had about 70% sensitivity. This is based on that PILPED 2 data that you already talked about. When we talked about slices of CT scan, this just has to do with how many little sensors and radiation beams are going on in the circular CT scan. And as we take that number from 4 up to 16 and 64, our sensitivity improves dramatically from about 70 to 83%. But remember in general that with the prevalence of population, the positive predictive value and negative predictive value come into play. If I got a negative CT scan, PILPED 2 said that my negative predictive value of a CT is about 95% in my low-risk population, 89% in intermediate-risk populations. Not great, but pretty darn good. But we also know that only 0.3% of patients in PILPED 2 that had a negative CT scan came back and had DVT that was found in ultrasound. So that number is really low. So let's look at this study right now. We simply want to know, can I use a CT scanner without lower extremity Dopplers as a rule-out to for evaluating pulmonary embolus? Now let's do a little board relevance here. We've got it. When you're evaluating anybody that comes in and you're thinking about PE, you've got to understand pre-test probability versus post-test probability and how that all works here. You've got to know this. The idea of a pre-test probability is saying, how likely is it that this patient has PE? And we're going to make it easy. It's going to be low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk. And there's a couple ways to think about that. We talked about Wells scoring in the earlier article. This article uses the revised Geneva score, which is a series of risk factors, symptoms, clinical signs that form up a clinical probability of low, intermediate, and high. And based on that risk, you might consider getting the D-dimer. You can go ahead and get a D-dimer if somebody has low or intermediate probability, as evidenced by this study. If you've got high clinical probability, the odds of you having having a PE is still high enough, even if you're, I don't really know what the D-dimer means there. Yeah. So you want to get a D-dimer if you're high clinical probability. Let's go to the next test. So that's the important board relevance. Really think about the idea of pre-test probability. All right, let's jump into this article. We're going to take 1,800 patients. Clinically, we think they could have PE. Just looking at them, well, maybe they got chest pain, shortness of breath, hemoptysis. I can't explain it. I, as the doctor, think, yes, they could have PE. So let's randomize them into two groups. The algorithm for randomization is a little bit tough to understand, but what you have to know is one group is going to use ultrasonography of the lower extremities, Doppler ultrasonography, as part of the diagnostic algorithm. The other one isn't. So each patient that goes through these two groups is going to get a modified Geneva score. If they're lower indeterminate risk, they're going to get a D-dimer. If it's negative, we stop. You're out. If the D-dimer is positive, or if you're high risk, group A is going to go right to CT scan. Group B is going to go to ultrasound. If ultrasound's negative, we're going to go to CT scan. Mm-hmm. Let's compare the results there. When we do that, the overall miss rate was 0.3% at 3 months in both groups. Mortality rates were the same. There was no difference in which algorithm we took. Very, very interesting in that ultrasonography really didn't help me rule out PE compared to the CT-PE protocol scan itself. Now, how does this matter? If you're thinking about PE, you've got a positive D-dimer, you're high risk. Let's go to scan right now. That's where the money shot is. You probably don't need the ultrasound for a PE rule out. That said, we can't CT scan everybody. The authors astutely note at the end here, well, if I had gone to the ultrasound first and just treated if I find a DVT, probably one patient out of every 10 that has PE could have been saved the radiation risks. We know that radiation risks are real, but in the operational clinical spectrum, not accounting for that radiation risk, I can go right to CT scan. With a negative CT scan, I can feel pretty darn comfortable up to about 99.5% that I'm not missing a lot in these patients.
Yeah, and that's the way I see it. The authors also note that there were a couple of patients that had a negative multi-slice CT, and two ended up with proximal DVTs. Now, these were off-protocol patients. They were patients that were randomized to the CT-only group. However, their physicians were uncomfortable and ended up ordering ultrasound, and so they found two more DVTs. Now, if you look at that, then that makes it 0.6% of patients that had thromboembolic risk in the CT-only group versus 0.3 in the other. However, it still shows that it's not inferior to the ultrasound strategy statistically.
There's one thing, we don't want to discount the utilization of ultrasound. It definitely serves a purpose. We need to think about radiation risk. Clearly, we're going to have patients that have contrast allergy, that have elevated creatinine, but it's not going to be safe, and it serves a good screening purpose, so I don't want to discount it here either.
No, ultrasound's a useful tool. The other thing to mention is D-dimer was used in this study as a rule out in both low and intermediate pretest probability patients, such that if they had a negative dimer, you're done. You're going home. You're not getting an ultrasound. You're not getting a CT. And none of the patients in follow-up within 3 months ended up with a DVT.
Key point here. We always talk about D-dimer in low probability patients. This is upping the ante a little bit and using it in intermediate probability patients. These patients did great as well.
And we'll have to see how this pans out, you know, in future larger studies. But so far, so good.
All right.
All right, next article. This is written by Dr. Klein, Jeffrey Klein. You know, when he came and did grand rounds here, it was so enjoyable. And this had not yet been finished. But this article is really fantastic, and it is huge. So it's prospective multi-center evaluation of the pulmonary embolism rule-out criteria written in Journal of Thrombosis and Hemostasis. Do you get that at the house, Ben?
You know, I usually read it for dinner every night, over dinner. Yeah. And my grandmother introduced it to me when I was young, and I haven't given it up yet. It's pretty amazing. I like the color scheme in it.
Anyway, it was in May of 08. So the historical backdrop, wouldn't it be nice if you could take a history and a physical and you could say to the patient, based on my bedside assessment, you do not have a PE. Then, with no additional labs, no expensive or potentially risky diagnostic workup, you could just send them home. That's the idea behind the PERC rule. PERC standing for pulmonary embolism rule-out criteria. PERC rule. In the original 2004 study, if the patient was PERC rule negative, they have a less than 2% chance of having a pulmonary embolus. Now, other historical backdrop that's important. We just spoke about the Wells score in PE. This is a useful tool to help us assign a pretest probability of PE using bedside variables, but it leaves a few things out. The PERC rule is a bit more extensive in what it covers, and it's been derived and internally validated, not necessarily to get to the pretest probability, but as a diagnostic test itself. If you are all negative on every variable on the PERC rule, then the idea is you can go home. You don't have a PE.
Oh, this is so exciting to think about any kind of test where I don't even need a D-dimer. I just stop.
Yeah, it would be wonderful. Dimers are painful. It's been internally validated, but the bottom line is it hadn't been externally validated in other centers, hence this gigantic study. Now, for the boards, you need to know the risk factors for DVT-PE. Now, we covered some of them with the Wells criteria, the Wells score, but the PERC rule gives us a little bit more. Now, very important, PERC rule assumes one thing right out of the chute, and it is a low clinical gestalt, meaning you walk in and you go, yeah, I don't think this person has a PE. Quantifiably, in the study, it was, I think this person has a less than 15% chance. So you're walking in already thinking, low prob. The other variables in the PERC rule are age less than 50, heart rate less than 100, O2 saturation greater than or equal to 95%. Now, this study was done in the Mile High area of the world, and so they lowered that to 90% for use in this study.
That's Denver, for those of you not moving real quick at home, but yep, props out to my hometown. All right, keep going.
5,280 feet.
There we go.
No unilateral leg swelling, no hemoptysis, no recent surgery that is in the past 28 days, no prior history of DVT-PE, and no estrogen use. If I may give a little acrostic as a memory aid for the PERC rule, would you like that, Ben?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, too, you know, we couldn't perk you because of your estrogen use. Oh, I'm sorry. Keep going.
I'm trying to cut down, and the fact that you publicly say that, it hurts me. But anyway, the
fact that your voice is this deep, well, being on estrogen is so impressive.
Well, I try. The acrostic is HAD clots.
That's HADCLOTS, HAD clots. H stands for hormone therapy. They can't be on that. A, age less than 50. D, DVT or PE, history. Can't have that. C is coughing blood. You're out if you've been hemoptysizing. L, leg swelling. Can't have unilateral leg swelling. O, O2-SAT has to be greater than 95% on room air. T stands for tachycardia. Your heart rate has to be less than 100. And S stands for surgery. You cannot have had surgery or recent trauma in the last 28 days. So that's HAD clots, the nice little acrostic so you can remember the PERC rule. And I'm sure you all will, and you will be tested on this. The results of the article. This was an enormous prospective multi-center study of 8,138 patients undergoing workup for pulmonary embolus at 13 emergency departments. The outcome was image-proven venous thromboembolism, I'm going to call that VTE, or death from any cause within 45 days. There was an overall rate of PE in the study of 6.9%. Of patients in whom clinicians thought the overall risk of PE was low and they were PERC negative, there were 15 cases of confirmed venous thromboembolism and one death. And this was not necessarily from PE, but was from end-stage cancer. Therefore, this calculates out to be a false negative rate of 16 out of 1,666 patients, or 1%. And the confidence intervals there are 0.6 to 1.6. Now, the authors caution that the rule may not perform as well in an environment that has a higher prevalence of venous thromboembolism. And before implementing and saying, all right, we're going to boot people out, kick them out the door if they're gestalt low, PERC negative, you need to do a little QA in an observational cohort before you implement this full bore as a diagnostic test. And interestingly, as we learned in Dr. Klein's Grand Rounds, this is billable. To use your brain and calculate a PERC rule is billable. I think it's got some sort of CPT code on it. Dr. Klein's point was, they'll pay us if we do a test. They won't pay us if we use our brains. We should get paid to use our brains, which I like.
I don't have a brain, though, so what's the problem? No. Anyway, keep going.
You're
going
to make less money. But the application of clinical practice, we can't keep scanning everybody that walks in the door that has squirrely chest pain or dyspnea. We're going to give people cancer without a doubt if we overuse CT. The problem is that if you miss a PE, the outcome could be fatal. The other problem is that medical-legally, it's unclear whether or not the PERC rule is going to protect an ED physician from suit if the patient has a bad outcome. This is a twisted environment in which we're not penalized for the potential future harm inflicted by medical radiation, but we are potentially penalized for using our brains instead of a CT scanner. It's a tough world that we live in. For your next shift, though, I would say learn the PERC rule, HAD clots. Even the low probability group using the Wells criteria, for example, to do a pretest prob, still in the low prob group had a 2 to 4% chance of venous thromboembolism. PERC is strong in that if you've got a patient that you just know is squirrely, their symptoms are squirrely, but they're saying they had chest pain or a little dyspnea, you don't need a D-dimer, you don't need a CTPA, you don't need a VQ, you don't need an ultrasound, you don't need a pulmonary angiogram, and blah, 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 and you're saying, I do not want to do some diagnostic workup on this patient. I just know that this is not a PE. Then perk them and send them home.
This is exciting stuff. With all these patients, though, to have a miss rate of less than 1% just using clinical decision rules is powerful. It's where medicine is going.
Yeah.
And start seeing it used in clinical practice because it's exciting.
You know, I think if we were Canadian, Ben, we'd be jumping up and down saying, yippee. But since we're from the States, yeah, I don't know if less than 1% is good enough. I like it, though.
But I do like your Canadian accent when you're talking about if we're from Canada right there. That last part, that was impressive.
That's for sure about that.
You're going to start playing hockey here soon and everything's over.
Whoa, watch out.
Okay.
Bottom line, if they're squirrely, perk them. And boot them. You like that?
I like it. Let's keep on moving. Next article, we're going to get away from PE. Let's start talking about sepsis. Clay, it's so interesting when you think about sepsis. Somebody comes into our big level one trauma center as a multi-trauma victim. They get the level one trauma activation. They move forward. They come in with a STEMI alert. Boom, they go right to the lab with protocols. Somebody comes in septic. Okay, let's give them some fluids, some antibiotics, kind of hang around. Yep. Nobody gets excited about that yet. Sepsis is such a huge killer.
Yeah.
750,000 people have severe sepsis in the U.S. every year. At least 200,000 people die annually in this country. We spend about $17 billion annually on sepsis. It's the real deal, and we need to do things to get it to the forefront of what we do in the emergency department. As early goal-directed therapies come to the forefront of what we do, we know that our actions in the emergency department have real positive impact on our patients with some defined treatment, some defined goals that we can target to see how our resuscitation is doing. So this article, let's take tens of the world's leading experts on sepsis. Let's get together in a big room. Let's talk sepsis. Let's make some good recommendations based on the most current scientific literature out there. So this big group, by the way, is called the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, and these are their international guidelines. Let's talk about board relevance. You got to know some definitions for the board. What is SIRS? Systemic Inflammatory Response Syndrome. The idea of inflammation throughout your body. There's a lot of definitions. Let's talk about the easy one. You've got to have two of the following four. Tachycardia, tachypnea, temperature imbalance, so either hyperthermia or hypothermia, and white cell changes, either a leukocytopenia or leukocytosis. You've got two of the four. You've got SIRS. Now, there's a lot of derivations of that, but you got to know that simple one. So what's sepsis? Well, that's saying I've got SIRS, and it's presumed to have infection. You don't have to even have a documented infection. I just look at this patient and say, wow, this patient has systemic inflammatory response, and I think they're also infected. Severe sepsis, all of a sudden I've got evidence of end-organ dysfunction. And remember, those are loose diagnoses. Maybe the patient's a little bit confused. They have an oxygen requirement. Their creatinine's bumped a little bit. Their LFTs are up. It looks like they don't have the cardiac output that they should. That's severe sepsis. Now, septic shock is where I have a patient who's presumed to be septic. I resuscitate them with fluids, and they remain hypotensive, requiring the use of vasoactive agents, vasopressors, inotropic agents, that sort of thing. Got to know those definitions. Now, what you also have to know are some core principles of early goal-directed therapy. We're going to talk about this idea. Now, I know the details of a lot of this are fraught with controversy, but you still need to know that early and aggressive resuscitation is important. And if you follow along in the handout we've got, I printed out the original paper from the New England Journal, that kind of flow chart from Manny Rivers talking about early line placement, appropriate fluid resuscitation, the addition of vasoactive agents, possible transfusion, inotropic agents as needed, all while targeting an SVO2 lactate levels, a response to resuscitation. You've got to know that for the boards. So let's talk about results. Well, the nice part about this is it wasn't really a study. This right. is taking all the results and let's put them together in one big article and review what we know and discuss the level of evidence. So that's going to go right into the application of clinical practice right here. So if you've been tuning out, get your cup of coffee, hit pause, and start listening, because this is what's important. The minute you recognize somebody with sepsis syndrome, number one, you've got 6 hours to get moving. 6 hours is a lot of time, but when I've got 20 active patients in the ED running around, 6 hours goes by quickly. Move fast. The most important thing you can do early on is source recognition and source control. If I've got a patient who's got an ischemic foot that's infected and I think that's coming off, I need to get the ortho or vascular guys on board because that leg's got to come off. Source control. Also, with source recognition involves early treatment. This group says within 1 hour of recognizing sepsis, antibiotics, appropriately targeted antibiotics, need to be on board.
It's like a STEMI alert. I mean, it really... But with sepsis, the clock is ticking. When they get in the door, every hour that goes by that they're not covered with appropriate antibiotics, their mortality goes up.
And I'm not talking door to needle. We're talking door to balloon. That is not the time that I order antibiotics. The time of your nurse fires up, stands up, and actually pushes those. All right. Now, if you're hypotensive, I don't care if you've got heart failure, Clay. I don't care if you're septic. I don't care if you're distributive. I don't care what's going on. Your first-line therapy remains a fluid challenge. The optimal goal is to think about a CVP between 8 and 12. Of course, you need to think about if somebody's in heart failure, you're not going to flood them with 5 liters of fluid and throw them in a heart failure. But your first line is always a fluid challenge with appropriate fluid resuscitation. Now, when somebody's become intravascularly replete and they're still hypotensive, your next move is to go onto a pressor agent, with dopamine or norepinephrine being your first two vasoactive agents of choice. After that, if a patient still shows markers of end organ lack of perfusion, where let's say their SVO2 remains low, their lactate remains high, you need to think about inotropic support. This implies your heart's not pumping out and getting blood to the peripheral tissues where they need them to be. And that's going to be with inotropic agents, things like dobutamine, but think about something that's going to make your heart squeeze a little bit better. Multiple ways to target tissue perfusion. If you go ahead and put a central line in, very easy to draw a mixed blood SVO2, also to draw a venous lactate, you can use that to target resuscitation. Clinical exam as well. Were they once cool? Are they now warm? How are their hemodynamics changing? Hemoglobin, remember we talked about hemoglobins of at least 10 in the Manning Rivers reviews. Here the group kind of backs off from that as well, says let's at least get our hemoglobin within 7 to 9. If I've got a patient with bad coronary disease, get their hemoglobin at 10. We've kind of known that for a while, so just at least think about hemoglobin. Here's a good one. We all know it. Easy to say, hard to do sometimes. Bicarb's worthless unless your pH is less than 7.15.
Yep.
Don't give it. You're just adding solute. You're not doing anything good there. Treat the underlying problem. Don't treat the number.
Yep.
Ah, the controversial steroid and shock. We're going to talk about this a little bit more. Know that this group doesn't make a real big recommendation saying that we need to give steroids in the setting of sepsis. You need to think about steroids if you're dealing with acute adrenal insufficiency. Activated protein C, Zygris. Don't be afraid to think about that in the emergency department either. That needs to be done, I say in my dogma, in coordination with your local intensivist, as they're going to be managing the patient and managing the side effects from the Zygris
right. As
well. But know that Apache score is greater than 25. Zygris does show a mortality. It is expensive. Low tidal volume ventilation strategies. If you've got a patient on a vent downstairs, you better be going 6 per kilo of ideal body weight. 10 per kilo is old school. It's out. You've got to know this. I know any of our patients that get intubated are going to be on the vent downstairs for a couple hours. It's my job as the ER guy to be sure that my respiratory therapist is using low tidal volume lung strategies. Very important. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. Clay, anybody in the room know anything about prevention, like DVT prevention? We in the ED need to prevent ulcers. We need to prevent DVT. We need to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia. Think about this. It's so easy. When's the last time I took an ED patient that I just intubated and sat him up to 45 degrees? I've got to be doing that more often. That saves lives. Hot off the press yesterday, even from JAMA, a new article talking about tight glycemic control. These authors still recommend tight glycemic control, but know that hypoglycemia is bad. If you're putting somebody on an insulin drip, you better be following the sugars closely because you don't want to bottom them out. Finally, if you're working in a pediatric center, know that a patient who gets septic and sick, especially a neonatal patient, there might be a role for IVIG, and peds patients whose lungs stop working, there might be a role for ECMO as well. That's a ton. We talked about a lot. If you got to remember anything right now, know that you've got to recognize sepsis early. You've got to act early. Think about antibiotics, fluid resuscitation, and pressors early. Got to remember that.
Now the question becomes, okay, so we've got the surviving sepsis campaign. We've got all these recommendations, but will they work? Will they lower mortality if they're implemented properly? And just as a comment on the surviving sepsis rules in general, there was an article that came out also in JAMA about several ICUs in Spain. And what they did was implemented an intensive educational program. They called it EduSepsis. And they educated nationwide these intensivists in Spain on the surviving sepsis campaign, on the resuscitation bundle, which we talked about, and on the other tasks to be completed during the management bundle. And they looked at outcomes. And shocker, what they found was that if you implement surviving sepsis campaign recommendations, that you survive sepsis better. There was a mortality benefit in the patients that had their intensivists trained in the surviving sepsis campaign recommendations. What they found was that these mortality benefits were enduring as well. They lasted even 12 months out. They found that individual surviving sepsis task completion waned as the educational intervention waned, but the mortality benefit persisted. So that's the bottom line. If you do surviving sepsis, you survive sepsis better. They estimated that if all hospitals in Spain had implemented this, it could have been over 400 lives saved. And that's nothing to sneeze at.
You ever been to Spain, Clay? Of course you have. Those who don't know it, Clay runs with the Bulls twice a year. He's actually trying to get bull running in Broadway here in Nashville, like right down the street with all the honky-tonks and music. It's going to be amazing.
I think it should be an Olympic event. No, I've never been to Spain. But I can say hola.
He actually rolls his Z's as well for those of you aficionados at home.
All right, we made it through surviving sepsis. We survived. Now, let's talk
a little bit.
Hopefully you, the listener, survived. Now we're going to talk a little bit about some press or agents. This is written by Anon et al. Norepinephrine plus dobutamine versus...
Would you apologize in French for us?
Mais oui. I don't even know how.
Je suis désolé. We'll keep you on the Spanish article. Keep going.
Yeah, lo siento. That's Spanish for Ben Heffron.
Spanish for French for I'm sorry? Wait, what? Okay.
no me gusta. Norepinephrine plus dobutamine versus epinephrine alone for management of septic shock. A randomized trial. This was written in Lancet in August of 2007. Historical backdrop. Patients in septic shock need adequate volume resuscitation and consideration of other causes for hypotension. If I may throw out another little acrostic, A, shock, anaphylaxis, sepsis, hypovolemia, obstruction, that means like tamponade, tension pneumo, cardiogenic, and this one's dumb, metabolic, L-I-C-K, A, shock.
I don't think it's dumb. I think it's special.
And under that metabolic category would be adrenal insufficiency. Now, once you've considered other causes of shock, you need to start a pressor agent if you've given them some volume and they're not able to maintain their mean arterial pressure. Now, theoretically, if a patient has septic shock and decreased cardiac output, the use of dobutamine plus norepinephrine versus epinephrine alone, you could maybe more accurately titrate to increase cardiac output more if they needed that. Cardiac index is a little low. Or maybe you could give them a little more vascular tone with the norepi if they needed that. So the concept was two agents titrated to meet the patient's needs would be superior to epinephrine alone, especially since some earlier studies have shown that epinephrine alone might decrease splanchnic blood flow and worsen acidosis. So they did this trial and they said, let's put these two drugs versus epi alone and put them head-to-head in a randomized trial, and that's what they came up with here. But before we get to the results of this article, the board relevance. For the boards, you need to know what we can do as emergency physicians to improve outcomes in septic patients. And I would just say, so as not to be like bashing us over the head with early goal-directed therapy, I'm going to bash us over the head with early goal-directed therapy. It's taught us that early and aggressive optimization of hemodynamic parameters using some volume, some pressors, and in that study, transfusion, improved outcomes and decreased mortality in septic patients. In addition to early goal-directed therapy, there are more things that we can do to improve outcome in septic patients, and these are covered in detail in Surviving Sepsis. Results of this study, however. This study enrolled 330 patients in septic shock in France. They used a protocol to randomize patients to one of two management strategies as per the diagram in the written version of this. They randomized them to either get norepi plus or minus dobutamine or straight up epinephrine. Now, this is easy. The results of this article are there was no difference in any outcome measure, especially the most important outcome measure, mortality, between the two groups. Amazing. It has been shown in prior studies that epi decreases splanchnic blood flow and causes increased acidosis. And in this study, they did indeed find that there was a transient effect just like that with epinephrine, but it was transient. We don't have to get into the exact numbers. Suffice it to say, norepi plus dobutamine was equivalent with straight up epi in this study. Application to your clinical practice. Follow surviving sepsis guidelines. Goal-directed therapy, cultures, antibiotics, remove the source. Give some fluid, give some pressors. But what pressors? Well, surviving sepsis would say their top two choices were dopamine and norepi. I would say this for your next shift. Hey, pick the presser that you're the most comfortable with and just go with it. If you like levofed, give it. If you like dopamine, give it. Hey, if you like epi, this article would suggest you've got some good, solid scientific basis to use it. So pick a presser, get familiar with it, and use it.
So I want to run with that a little bit, because the bottom line here is when your patient is sick and septic, you need to do something to get their blood pressure up right now. And we're going to talk about a second article as well here. I just want to comment a little bit about this study out of the New England Journal back in February. There's a thought that vasopressin, an endogenous type of hormone that has great vascular tone but doesn't have the negative drawbacks of causing this microcirculatory spasm, over-squeeze, there's theory that maybe this is a little bit better. Let's randomize 778 patients. They've all got to be sick. They've got to be in septic shock. They've all got to be on low-dose norepinephrine. And let's either dial up the norepi or let's add on vasopressin. Mortality at 28 days in both groups was same. So that physiologic theoretical benefit that you've heard about before may not necessarily be the case. Bottom line is, think about your bundles in early goal-directed therapy. Think about your first-line pressors. Epi is actually a great drug. Think about the downsides, especially in the elderly, something that's not going to have that over-squeeze on the vasculature. That epinephrine might, vasopressin might be good. Maybe it's that elderly person with triple vessel disease that's actively infarcting right now. I don't know if I want to put them on an epi drip. Vasopressin might be okay here. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're keeping right along. Now, we've been talking about sepsis and critical care. Any talented emergency physician has to have a grasp of ARDS, acute lung injury, and managing ventilation and oxygenation in the emergency department. As we're seeing boarding times grow, not only are we emergency physicians, we're intensivists, and acting like an intensivist is very exciting fun. I think this is some of the coolest stuff we do. But I want to talk right now about an article from JAMA this February looking at ventilatory strategies and changing PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure. How might variations in PEEP actually affect outcomes? So let's get into this just right away with historical backdrop. Some context here. We know that low tidal volume strategies are the way to go in ARDS. We've known this for a while. 10 cc's per kilo is old school. Get it out of your mind. We don't use that. You want to be 6 cc's per kilo of ideal body weight. You've got to know that. Now remember that both oxygenation and ventilation in ARDS and in lung injury in general for that matter are complicated. When you think about the pathophysiology, we've got VQ mismatch, you have pulmonary edema. I don't want to think about barotrauma. I don't want to think about free radical damage. Excuse me. I don't want to think about it? Of course I want to think about it, but I don't want it to happen.
You don't want to cause it.
I don't want to cause it. So oxygenation and ventilation strategies in ARDS are difficult because think about how interdependent and interlinked VQ mismatch, pulmonary edema, and barotrauma are, all combined with free radical damage based on my vent settings. But this article brings to light the idea of atelectrauma, a new concept. A-T-E-L-E-C-T-R-A-U-M-A. Say that four times fast. Atelectrauma, 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 atelectrauma. Good job. This is the whole idea as well, that as my alveoli open and close in a repetitive nature while I'm mechanically ventilated, that causes shear force. This might increase inflammation, increase free radical production, actually worsen mortality. Now, this is a relatively new idea, I think, in the emergency department, but it's something that the smarties up in our MICU have been thinking about for a while. What can we do to mitigate atelectrauma? That's what this study is going to look at right now. Originally, this involves the idea of alveolar recruitment. If I can recruit alveoli, if I can keep the alveoli open, maybe this atelectrauma will improve. We know historically there's some studies that suggest with high tidal volumes, if I go ahead and shunt the alveoli open all the time, the patients did better. Nobody's ever looked at this, though, with low lung tidal volume strategies. So here's what you've got to know for your boards. Let's keep it simple. When I've got a vent, I affect ventilation and oxygenation. Ventilation, thus minute ventilation, is affected by my tidal volume and respiratory rate. Those are my two dependent variables. You've got to know how to oxygenate a patient. Oxygenation, the PaO2 in the blood, is affected by the FiO2, that's the percentage of oxygen going through the vent into the ET tube and into the lungs, as well as by PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure. PEEP, the higher the PEEP, the more alveoli are continuously recruited and kept open. Thus, the greater amount of time during the respiratory cycle that oxygen is within the alveoli that can passively diffuse into the capillary. You've got to know the concepts of oxygenation and ventilation and how those are two different, essentially independent factors. We're not going to talk about high ventilatory strategies, how if I can change actually my vent cycle and go from volume control to pressure control and how that can affect oxygenation. Don't worry about that. You just have to know that oxygenation and ventilation are two separate entities that I affect with different knobs on the vent. Very, very important. You got to know low lung tidal volumes. 60 cc's per kilo of ideal body weight. That's the way to go.
Yeah, and that's ideal body weight predicted on the basis of the patient's height. You don't want to give 60 cc's per kilo if they weigh 500 pounds.
5'2", 600 pounds, and all of a sudden you're giving them a 2 liter, a 2 liter tidal volume. All of a sudden you're blowing out both lungs. Let's talk a little bit more about alveolar recruitment strategies. That's very important here in thinking about atelect trauma. That's what that's looking at. That's by increasing PEEP, keeping the alveoli open, side breaths, a very large tidal volume, a couple breaths a day to recruit the alveoli, keep them open, improve VQ mismatching. These are all part of the idea of alveolar recruitment. So let's look at this study. Again, another randomized trial, about 1,000 patients, 983 to be exact. All of these patients had markers of acute lung injury, some with ARDS. PF ratio is less than 250. You might need to know in your boards a PF ratio less than 300 is a marker for ALI, less than 200 for ARDS. Everybody got low lung ventilation strategies, but the experimental arm had some hyperinflation techniques, relatively higher doses of PEEP, and higher plateau pressures. And this was all done on pressure-controlled ventilation, which may or may not be applicable depending on the ventilatory strategy at your institution. Regardless, when plateau pressures and PEEP are up, yes, the intrathoracic pressure is increased, but hopefully the alveoli are shunted open more of the time and this atelect trauma is reduced. At least that's the theory. Unfortunately, all-cause mortality was the same in both groups, between 36 and 40%. The experimental arm, though, remember that's the group where we had the higher PEEPs, who were recruiting alveoli a little bit more, had a lower incidence of refractory hypoxemia, lower incidence of rescue therapy use. Rescue therapy is when stuff's hitting the tank, I put a patient on an oscillatory ventilator, I go for prone positioning, that kind of thing that's pretty aggressive as some last-ditch efforts to keep a patient oxygenating well. Now, how am I going to use this in practice? Well, you're right. Higher PEEP here, Clay, didn't really help overall mortality, but it didn't necessarily hurt. And I'm not convinced we know what patients need high PEEP and which ones don't. I think you really have to know what's going on at the level of alveoli, and we don't really have markers for that. It's possible that some patients are over-distended. It's possible that some are under-distended. I don't think you can take every patient with ARDS and say, let's go up on their PEEP. We've got to figure out some way to individualize this and say what patients are at risk for atelect trauma. How is their compliance affected? I think this is a lot more intricate and delicate than we're appreciating right now, and the authors agree with that as well. That you got to think again about these patient-centered endpoints, mortality. Sepsis still kills. We're not improving mortality, but there's some clinical endpoints that have some benefit here. Perhaps a real small subset of sick patients, those that have worsening ARDS, PF ratios way less than 200, might benefit from this low lung volume, higher PEEP strategies. We don't really know yet. We're going to have to keep looking.
Yeah, so stay tuned. I'm sure the pulmonary docs will be giving us more information. But I think the take-home point is still go with low tidal volume ventilation, but a higher PEEP strategy, whether it affects mortality. According to this study, it didn't. And so we'll have to just stay tuned and see what else happened.
Clay, wouldn't it be great if I could prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia from the emergency department?
That would be awesome, Ben.
We're all about awesomeness here. We're going to talk about the nascent trial. What's nascent mean, by the way?
It means being born.
Oh, yeah. Like naissance, French. We're keeping it Euro this time, remember. All things Euro, this edition of Keeping Up.
Nativity.
There we go. COLEF. This is the nascent trial from JAMA. Recent article, August 20th. You might not have heard it yet. Remember, though, that VAP's the real deal. One out of every four patients, approximately, that you intubate is going to develop ventilator-associated pneumonia. Maybe one out of every three or four of these patients that get VAP are going to die. That's the real deal. One out of every 12 patients that I intubate is going to die from ventilator-associated pneumonia. Do I do my math right? That's high.
Yikes.
That's really scary. Is there anything I can do to prevent that? Well, we know a lot of prevention strategies already, Clay. I need to elevate a patient's bed at least to 30, preferably 45 degrees. I need sterile technique on my procedures, appropriate mouth care, enteral feeding, preferably with a post-pyloric tube. There's some data to suggest that. Well, maybe the type of endotracheal tube I use might have a really good effect, and that's what this study is all about. This is a kind of first-of-its-kind landmark study looking at a silver-lined endotracheal tube. The whole problem with normal endotracheal tubes is they're prone to bacterial colonization and something called a biofilm formation. Doesn't it sound like bad plaque or tartar? Nobody likes that. Maybe this is kind of reminds me of switching to a new kind of toothpaste, but we'll slow down. Board relevance. You've got to know about ventilator-associated pneumonia. Even in the emergency department, you have to know that it's real. The definition is clinical suspicion of pneumonia, the gold standard being a colonization of at least 10 to a fourth CFUs in the micro lab after I get a BAL. And I've been intubated for, some used to say 48 hours. It's actually now just 24 hours. That's how we diagnose. It's a very common killer. And the pathogens are usually those nasty nosocomial ones. Your resistant MRSA, resistant Klebsiella, Stenotrophomonas, Acinetobacter, all these ones that are crazy to spell. And you hear them, you say, oh, that sounds terrible. You need to know these prevention strategies as well. It's important to put the head of the bed up in sterile technique, even in the ED. Sterile line placement in the ED, yes, can help prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia, as odd as that sounds. So let's take this pilot study. Let's randomize about 2,000 patients, 1,000 in each arm. Let's intubate them with my boring old generic endotracheal tube, and let's intubate them with this new silver-lined endotracheal tube in my experimental arm, and let's see what happens. Well, guess what? Well, in this study, these folks did pretty well. The incidence of VAP in the control arm was only 7.5%. But with the silver tube, 4.8%. If I do my math right there, that's what, 2.7% absolute risk reduction with a 38% relative risk reduction. If I do the math right, we take 1 over the absolute risk reduction. That's going to be a number needed to treat around 37.
37.
It's still a lot, but something to think about. Total time of intubation didn't change. The time to developing VAP was actually longer in the silver lining group. No real differences in any kind of adverse event between the two groups. Something to think about here. What am I doing with this? How am I applying it? Well, it's a new topic. This is a first study of any kind. I'm a little bit leery to believe everything here because this was a funded surprise by the people who make this new silver-lining endotracheal tube. So we're going to have to validate that. That's always something that inherently could have bias when the manufacturer funds the study. Got to think about that. But let's do a little bit of math. The authors say that anytime somebody gets a VAP, it costs $40,000. Very good. Let's say the number needed to treat is actually 40.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Every time I use one of these, the cost-benefit break-even point, 4,000 divided by 40, is $1,000. So as long as the endotracheal tube itself doesn't cost more than $1,000 from my typical generic tube, from these numbers, it's worthwhile. And I can't expect the price point here being that high. We'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah.
But anything I can do to cut back on VAP, cut back on the $40,000 that the ICU has to spend to treat that, and of course, cut back on mortality, that's key. We got to learn a little bit more about prevention control in these groups. How do they differ? So we're going to need some validation, but stay tuned. I think there's something here. Something tells me in a couple more years we're going to be using endotracheal tubes with specific linings to prevent infection.
Yeah, I think it could be a silver lining of the dark cloud of ventilator-associated pneumonia.
I like that. You know, it only costs me, I think, about $0 also just to elevate the head of the bed 45 degrees after I intubate somebody and they hang out for 6 hours in the ED before we're going upstairs. I got to do that too. Hello, ready to move on?
We are. We're Zing. Ready. Et al. Effect of carbocysteine on acute exacerbation of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This is the PEACE study, a randomized placebo-controlled study written in The Lancet, June of 2008. The historical backdrop. The classic mucolytic agent that we use in the United States is guaifenesin. Now, guaifenesin's been packaged and repackaged under a lot of different brand names. A lot of people are going after Mucinex right now in droves.
Great commercials with the little, like, purple
mucus
fungus
guy.
Mucus dude jumping all around looking all bad.
Oh, yeah. And then Mucinex comes in and saves the day and boots him out.
And you brand name it, and you can charge whatever you want for it right now because you just modified the packaging a little bit. But
yeah,
I digress.
It's just straight-up guaifenesin. It's just Robitussin. With a new name. That's the mucolytic that's often used in the U.S. Now, in the past, some studies have shown that the use of mucolytics improves airway clearance, and some have shown no difference in COPD patients with mucolytics. But a recent 2006 Cochrane review showed that oral mucolytic therapy reduced annual exacerbations and reduced the number of days of disability in patients that had COPD. So I think there is something to it. I'm not sure if the little mucus man is telling us the truth and that Mucinex is the wave of the future, but there's something to it. Now, in this study, the drug used was carbocysteine. It's a mucolytic, but it also has anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties, and that probably contributes significantly to its clinical effects. The nearest cousin in the U.S. would be N-acetylcysteine, or NAC. Now, carbocysteine is only available in Europe and Asia, but we've got NAC here in the U.S. And so,
remember NAC, mucomist, originally used for breaking up mucus.
And boy, is it stinky.
Boy, for some historical backdrop. We'll continue on, Clay. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Rotten eggs. Board relevance. For the boards, you need to know that COPD is managed in the ED with beta-2 agonists, anticholinergics like ipratropium, steroids, and often we use magnesium sulfate. The role of antibiotics in acute COPD exacerbations is less clear. Also, don't forget, this is a classic case. What they'll present on your boards is a COPD patient. They present with an exacerbation. They suddenly decompensate and have PEA arrest. Now, the answer to the question is, put a chest tube in the side that you think has the pneumothorax.
Or needle thoracostomy.
Don't wait for x-ray results if they decompensate. They'll present something like that.
Put them in both sides if you don't even know. That's what's going on.
Yeah, two procedures. The results of this trial. This enrolled 709 Chinese patients to receive carbocysteine, 1,500 milligrams a day, or placebo. It was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. The baseline characteristics were the same in each group, that is, placebo and carbocysteine groups, and all patients were 40 to 80 years old and had an FEV1 to FVC ratio of less than 0.7, or an FEV1 that was 25 to 79% of predicted for age and height. The primary outcome was the rate of exacerbations per year. And what they found was the carbocysteine group did better. They had one exacerbation per year versus the placebo group, which had 1.35 exacerbations for a risk ratio of 0.75. So these findings were highly statistically significant. And it also improved symptom scores at 1 year. Now, early improvements weren't seen, that is, within the first 3 months, suggesting that longer-term treatment would be most beneficial. There were 10 people that were lost to follow-up in the treatment arm, 21 in the placebo, and fortunately, there were no adverse effects in either arm. Also keep in mind, this was an industry-funded study by Kyorin Pharmaceuticals, which apparently makes carbocysteine. So take it with a grain of salt, but it seemed to do better. I'm not sure how you have a 0.35 of an exacerbation, but it must be kind of mild. But anyway, the application to your clinical practice, I think the mucolytic debate's still open. I don't think that we can totally poo-poo mucolytics and say that they don't work, but I don't know that I'm necessarily ready to just jump on the bandwagon either. But I think you might be saying, okay, what does carbocysteine, which is available in Europe and Asia in a Chinese study, have to do with emergency department practice? And that would be a legitimate question, but I hope to answer it with this. With the advent of direct-to-consumer advertising by a green glob of mucus being swept away by a revamped guaifenesin, I think it's worth our time to see what the growing body of evidence is when we write or are asked to write for drugs such as guaifenesin or Mucinex. For your next shift, I say this. I think the jury's still out on how clinically important the role of mucolytics and the findings of this article are. It seems that they do play a role in the long-term management of COPD, and they don't seem to have any adverse effects according to this trial and the recent Cochrane review. So the bottom line is you may be helping your patients by using mucolytics and prescribing them from the ED, and it's not going to hurt them. So stay tuned. There should be more studies out on this in the future. What do you think?
Allow me to just be the pragmatist here. How many of my patients love to come in and say, yeah, I'm coughing. I'm taking that Robitussin. It's not doing anything. And we all kind of laugh. Like, good for you. You've got your viral upper respiratory infection. What's going on? What? Are you telling me right now, Clay, that maybe someday I can be like, hey, your Robitussin's actually good for you, even though you're smoking four packs a day and don't want to quit and barrel-chested and a blue bloater and all that. Hey, but keep taking your Robitussin, buddy. Maybe this is a good thing? Yeah, maybe that's where we're going with this. I don't know. You think about all the other things that we try to do. We do a lot of antibiotics for sputum changes and COPD flares. We do steroids all of the time. It'd be great to have something where I could prevent that guy from coming in 4 months later from having a COPD flare in my ED. Emergency medicine is moving towards prevention. It's a fact of where we're going. We need to think about what we can do for our patients to prevent exacerbations of disease in the future. That's what we're looking for. I don't know that this is practice changing yet for me, but it's something I'm going to keep my eye on if mucolysis in general is appropriate in the COPD population. So I'm interested to see where this early study takes us with some validation in the future.
I mean, thrombolysis, mucolysis, it's all there.
We're all about the lysis, except in the head.
All right, next article, effective induction agents on vasopressor and steroid use and outcome in patients with septic shock.
This was written... the raciest topic, Clay. Etomidate adrenal insufficiency. Bring it. Every fight between emergency medicine, inside emergency medicine, and the critical care folks. Here we go.
All right, so we're going to talk about etomidate here. And now, for the historical backdrop, etomidate unequivocally inhibits 11-beta-hydroxylase. I'm sorry, this was written by Ray et al. It does inhibit 11-beta-hydroxylase. Essentially, it causes what would be the equivalent of 11-beta-congenital adrenal hyperplasia.
For a 24-hour period approximately. I think that's what we're going for
that's
right
now. It's a transient CAH. The effect is short, lasts maybe up to 24 hours.
The genitalia remain the same.
That's handy. Very handy. Yeah, I think if that was a problem with the etomidate,
we'd be back to Versed so quick.
No, you're like, I don't care if you are hypotensive. Anyway, we really digress there. But debate continues about the importance of etomidate's adrenal suppression side effect on important patient outcomes. And I will tell you this. There is a point-counterpoint on this topic in the Annals of Emergency Medicine, July 2008. It's a must-read. Ron Walls versus...
some other guy.
Dr. Sacchetti is the guy.
And like I said, he sounds like some other guy.
They duke it out. And so I think that you should probably read that. But suffice it to say, some would advocate that other drugs like ketamine should be used for induction in unstable patients. Others say etomidate is such a safe drug from a cardiovascular standpoint and an intracranial pressure standpoint that its use should continue. We know that hypotension in the ED forebodes higher mortality and a worse outcome. So some would say, why would you give a drug that's going to make a patient hypotensive? You know, if you give them a swig of propofol and they're already fragile from a hemodynamic standpoint, they're going to drop their pressure. And we know that dropping your pressure in the ED makes outcomes worse.
Naughty.
But
we
also know that adrenal insufficiency increases mortality. It makes people worse. So anyway, that's the debate. That frames it a little bit. For the board relevance, you need to know that at this point, etomidate is a first-line drug for rapid sequence intubation. The induction dose is 0.3 milligrams per kilogram. It does not tend to exacerbate hypotension in hemodynamically compromised patients and does not excessively raise or lower intracranial pressure. Its side effects can be burning with injection, myoclonus, and definitely transient adrenal suppression. Let's look at the results of this article. This is a small retrospective chart review, and the methods are defined. They looked at 159 septic shock patients. The overall mortality was pretty high, 65%. Etomidate was given in 70 of these, propofol in 25, thiopental in 26, and other agents in 18, and 16 had no induction agent at all. They just coded and got tubed. This Scottish ICU gave hydrocortisone to patients with refractory hypotension, unresponsive to volume and to pressors. By protocol, they didn't do cord stim testing. So what they found was the induction agent used did not affect patient outcome, that is mortality especially. It did not affect vasopressor use, and it did not affect the need for steroid replacement based on their protocolized use of hydrocortisone in this ICU. Steroid use did not improve the outcome in patients that were induced with etomidate. And they did find that intensive management of hypotension upon induction was required far more frequently
with the other agents, over 25% of the time versus about 10% of the time with etomidate. So the application for your clinical practice, I'd say on the basis of this article, I think it's still wise to use etomidate in your hemodynamically compromised patients. We know hypotension in the ED is bad. It increases mortality. It appears from this retrospective review that the use of etomidate did not lead to increased mortality, pressor use, or steroid replacement when you compare it with the other induction agents. So at this point, the evidence suggests that etomidate is still safe. I would say this, until a big randomized trial proves differently, it's still going to be my first choice for induction in the ED. Now we'll talk about this a little bit more in the next article, the Corticus trial, because it mentions etomidate use as well, that it may increase mortality a little bit. But again, we'll discuss further. What do you think, Ben?
I'm like you. I'm in the Ron Wallace camp here right now. Yes, we know that we're having adrenal insufficiency for 24 hours. So Clay, the interesting part of this is we know etomidate causes adrenal suppression, but this gets right back to the patient-oriented outcome. This isn't really having an effect on mortality. My patients are doing the same whether or not I use etomidate, as this study shows. I like Ron Wall's idea here. Go ahead and intubate with etomidate. Use it for rapid sequence induction. This is your sedative hypnotic of choice. Tell the admitting team, yes, I used etomidate. If they're concerned about clinically significant adrenal insufficiency over the first 24 hours, they know how to act. But you've got to think, I need a sedative hypnotic to rapid sequence. There's significant downsides to using benzodiazepines all the way to maybe causing delirium in the ICU that we just heard about. Ketamine, I've got to worry about some increased intracranial pressure, which isn't necessarily a good thing. Propofol, the hypotensive effects, the same thing with the barbiturates. It's a good agent, but it's not perfect. Until something comes out better, I think I'm still using it.
Me too. Etomidation for intubation. Right, here we go. Corticus.
All right, last but not least, bringing it home. The first time you hear corticus, don't you think it's about some study on central line placement?
I don't know. It sounds like a Roman soldier or something.
Cortis, come on. Nobody followed that
listening. Dang.
Cortis, corticus, but I'm just kind of slow. Yeah, but I could see that Roman soldier, you know, that sounds like something out of...
on corticus.
What's the movie that I'm trying... Yeah, thank you. Everybody's heard about this story. Landmark study out of New England Journal this past January. We know the controversy of the use of hydrocortisone in the setting in septic shock continues. We've talked earlier about the idea of treatment bundles, early goal-directed therapy, and the controversy of hydrocortisone I want to discuss right now. Historically, we know that sepsis isn't bad. You've heard this a couple times. Did I say isn't bad? I'm really having issues right now. Historically, we know.
I'm going to correct that and say sepsis is bad.
Sepsis is bad. Sepsis so sucks. Sepsis kills.
Take home point. Sepsis.
Sepsis ain't
bad.
Sweet. Sepsis so lame. Remember, in-hospital mortality of severe refractory sepsis, 33 to 60%. That's huge. Think about whether we tolerate that in the setting of acute coronary syndrome or trauma. Of course we wouldn't. We in the emergency department have a vital role in recognizing and treating sepsis early with our bundles, source control, early antibiotics, fluid resuscitation, markers of perfusion. The real question is, does hydrocortisone help? Think about this idea pathophysiologically. In the sepsis state, a body's got an overwhelming stress response. Your adrenals are just squeezing out everything they can. It makes sense that all of a sudden I'd be developing a relative adrenal insufficiency. So steroid replacement might make sense. But steroids have risk. We know that. Steroids have an immunomodulatory effect. Steroids make white cells that sometimes not do exactly what they should. We know that steroid use causes a GI bleed. If you're acutely septic and having an upper GI bleed, that's a death sentence. So there's definitely a risk and benefit right there. Earlier research, some earlier studies in JAMA prior to corticus suggest that certain patients who receive steroid replacement in the setting of severe sepsis actually did okay. Other studies have reputed this. This study attempts to answer the same question. Board relevance. Remember that shock, we talked already about the broad differential for shock. We have to think about it. We talked about the mnemonic earlier with Clay. Think about cardiogenic, neurogenic, obstructive, hypovolemic, and distributive shock. Last but not least, refractory shock. You've got to think about adrenal insufficiency, especially if you've got lab tests that come back with relative hypoglycemia, hyperkalemia, and hyponatremia. Your light bulb inside your head just needs to go on. That hamster running on the cage inside my brain needs to start running a little faster. Something else might be going on here. So let's go right to the meat of corticus. Let's talk about the results. This is a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial. 250 patients with septic shock going to each arm. Remember, septic shock is sepsis, end-organ dysfunction, hypotension that's refractory to fluid replacement. These patients have to be sick at baseline. Experimental arm is going to get 50 milligrams of IV hydrocortisone every 6 hours for 5 days. And actually doing a taper here as well. Let's do a 6-day taper. The experimental arm gets a nice dose of salt water, a good placebo effect, nothing else. The authors looked at the 28-day mortality rates. They looked at them in both arms. And they also looked for whether or not the patients failed a cort stim test in each arm, using this as a proxy to say, is the patient really adrenally insufficient? Now, that's a whole different discussion, but let's just call it what it is right now. The authors suggest if you're failing your cort stim test, it means, yes, I'm adrenally somewhat insufficient. Yeah. So you've got a 2x2 table here, experimental controlled, adrenally insufficient, as evidenced by failing a cort stim test, or adrenally replete, if you will.
Yeah.
I passed my cort stim test. Anybody who received hydrocortisone, did not receive hydrocortisone, was adrenally insufficient or not, the mortality was the same in all four groups. Patient-centered outcome, no real change. Didn't do better, didn't necessarily do worse. Let's look at this a little bit further, though. If a patient got hydrocortisone in the experimental arm, their shock state was reversed more rapidly than the placebo group. However, there was multiple episodes where the incidence of superinfection was higher. That includes new sepsis and septic shock. The authors kind of postulate later to say, well, maybe hydrocortisone improves my blood pressure. That's a good thing. But maybe it really does increase my incidence of infection. What's a bad thing? And the two might neutralize themselves. Well, this is interesting because the mortality effects we saw earlier aren't necessarily there anymore. So, Clay, I want to bring up an important point that you mentioned, which is very interesting in this study. Let's talk about power. Power is the idea, how many patients do I need in a study to see a measurable effect with 80% certainty? Talk about the power of this study, Clay.
Well, they had done their sample size calculations and determined that they needed 800 patients for it to be adequately powered to show a statistical difference in the mortality, and they ended up only enrolling 500. The editorial mentions that the study was indeed underpowered, and it looks like they just ran out of funding. But still, I think that some of the conclusions that the study draws are valid, and especially since this is the largest study of its kind to date, it's still worth looking at, and still we can learn quite a lot from the findings. But keep that in mind as you're interpreting these results.
So, how are we going to apply this? So I think that the addition of steroids in the early goal-directed therapy bundle is further down the line of importance. But I still think I need to think about it here from this. If I think that a patient's adrenally insufficient, if they've got refractory shock, I think there still could be a role for hydrocortisone. I don't think that poo-poos things here. I do think we need to know that there's a downside to using steroids, especially with superinfection and GI bleeds, but there really could be an upside, especially in a patient who I think is adrenally insufficient.
Yeah, I'm still going to think about it. If I have a patient that I've given a lot of volume, given pressors, still hypotensive, it's refractory, I'm probably going to give it.
But I don't think I need to be giving it to everybody.
No, I agree with that.
I don't think
totally
I need to. I think this is not part of our bundle where I do it all the time, just like everybody gets antibiotics. Not everybody needs to get steroids right now.
I totally agree with
Let's
that.
Let's throw the little aside. The author's postdoc did look a little bit at etomidate, and guess what? They found an association with the use of etomidate in a failed cort stim test. That's a whole different bag of worms. That's not what this study is about, but the etomidate dilemma, the etomidate discussion continues.
Yeah, and one wonders, with their post hoc analysis, there was an increased rate of death at 28 days in patients who had received etomidate before they were randomized into one of the groups. So more people died who got etomidate versus those who didn't. So the question then becomes, is etomidate causal here, or is it simply that the patients that were induced with etomidate were already sick and hemodynamically compromised, and that's why they chose etomidate? So, you know, I don't think that this study was meant to solve that question. The bottom line is, I'm still using etomidate until a randomized controlled trial tells me that it's unsafe, because I know if patients drop their pressure, there's a good chance they're going to die. And so I don't want to give them a big swig of propofol.
So what's the most fun line to give at the end of any research study? The ultimate cop-out, which we're giving you, more research is needed.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of Keeping Up. And Ben, I appreciate you coming out. And,
thanks for having me, Clay. Listeners, thanks for putting up with my antics.
We're going to do a special episode of resuscitation-based articles. We just didn't have room for them in our pulmonary critical care topic list. We had too many other important studies to do, so stay tuned. And now, for a little legal and CME mumbo-jumbo that we have to take care of. Keeping Up is copyright Vanderbilt University. 2008-2009, all rights reserved. Please don't make copies or change the content in any way, but please do tell your friends about this, because that's the way we're going to spread the word. Don't forget to get your CME credit. You can get that by going to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and follow the links. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for CME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine designates this educational activity for a maximum of 1.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Thanks so much for listening to Keeping Up. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we hope you'll listen again and tell your friends. Thanks. Bye.